From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Syrian facilities targeted by the strikes of the U.S. military and its allies a week ago were not used for storing chemical weapons, and samples taken from there confirm this. That, according to the chief of Russia's general staff's main operations directorate, Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy, who spoke at a news briefing in Moscow Wednesday.
The OPCW experts arrived to the place and inspected it. 2014. They stated that there was no activities conducted in relation to anything which has to do with the prohibited activities or agents. Then, the Homs province. This facility has never seen any chemical weapons, no researches, no storage, never. Then, Khemshishar
warehouse.
Also, this place has never seen any chemical agents, no manufacturing, no storage of any agents. In a country which produces and stores chemical weapons, these places are always protected and secured because these agents are dangerous to people. But these three facilities have never seen any security measures, just ordinary hangars, buildings. Right after the strikes, a lot of people been to these places, spectators, without any means of protection. None of them was poisoned or else. Also, in order to conduct investigation whether there was any possible contamination, Russian personnel arrived there to take the samples to see whether this place is contaminated. The samples, the analysis revealed complete lack of any chemical agent exposure, which again testifies that this institution has not been conducting any activities related to chemical agents for quite a long time. We don't see the reasoning behind the actions of France, US, and UK. If they say that there were chemical agents on these places, then after a strike, cruise missile strike, then all these areas would have been contaminated. And when it comes to Damascus, dozens of thousands of people would have been dead. As for the strike itself, the United States, France, and the UK conducted the strikes and stated that the strikes were completely successful. They say that all missiles completed the mission, and the center near Damascus was targeted by over 70 cruise missiles, and the Khemshishar storage facility was tracking with over 30 missiles. The overall count of missiles used, over 100. We analyzed the strike in every detail, gathering the wreckage and pieces of the missiles, analyzing the targets. We have conducted investigation, and we can say that we've seen not more than 22 explosions, places where missiles struck. As for Damascus, only 13 missiles hit the target, not 76, as they say. We see the debris of a building which used to be the institution, but the buildings around are completely intact. The Tomahawk cruise missile has the warhead of over 150 kilograms. It seems that if we take two BA-1B strategic bombers, over 7.5 tons of explosives should have been there. It means that the whole area would have been razed to the ground, but that's not the case, as you can see, judging by the photos. Objective control data shows, as well as witnesses' reports, that the Panzer OSA, Strela 10, Buk, Quadrat, S-125, and other anti-missile air defense systems which got the sky above Damascus and the air bases, many other places, have destroyed over 70 cruise missiles. Judging by the trajectories and the Syrian capabilities for air defense, they've been destroyed in 5 locations, 3 to the west of Damascus, 2 to the east of it. Fragments of cruise missiles were found there. They include the holes and all the other evidence to maintain that these cruise missiles were intercepted. It includes serial numbers, manufacturers' names, and other information which helps to unambiguously identify the origin of these objects. This is one of them. After the briefing, you'll be able to analyze it in greater detail. Some missiles failed to hit the targets due to tactical failures, as we believe. This way, posing a huge threat to the people and civil objects. Two of them, the Jasmine and Tomahawk, were delivered to Moscow. Their payload is also presented on one of the slides, right here. They are being analyzed and inspected by specialists. The results of this analysis will be used in order to enhance Russian defense capabilities. Now, the Himshimshar facility, where, according to the U.S. version, according to the U.S. theory, chemical weapons were stored. The Pentagon say that over 20 missiles hit the target. We've seen only 7 places where rockets hit, and you can see the satellite image to support our statements. As for a different place, they say 7 missiles hit the target, but we see only 2 so-called smart missiles, mostly damaged civil infrastructure, which has nothing to do with any military capabilities. In 3 interception areas, Homs, for instance, air defense systems such as Buk, OSA, S-125 and Quadrat of the Syrian forces intercepted 20 missiles. You can see the fragments of these missiles both on the slides and right in front of me. Most of the high-precision smart missiles were intercepted by very old Russian air defense capabilities, which are more than 40 years of age, OSA, Quadrat, and others. They've been modernized with the help of the Russian specialist. Ministry of Defense of Syria analyzed in detail the results of the strikes and the interception procedures. They already are introducing enhancements and changes to the air defense system in order to increase level of security and air defense protection of Syria. We'll also be deliberating over possible delivery of necessary air defense system to Syria, which will be conducted in due time. No cruise missiles happen to be within the range of Russian air defense forces stationed there. We're ready to repel any kind of air attack. 10 kilometers ago from the Khmeimim air defense, yesterday, 2 unmanned vehicles, aerial vehicles used by militants were intercepted. Nothing can stop the process of liberation in Syria. Ghouta is coming back to normal life in this suburb of Damascus. Authorities are now conducting the necessary procedures and everything which is needed to restore the normal life of people. There is electricity, stores and shops are open, and the prices on food has decreased by several fold. The southern and of Damascus, the Yarmouk area, is being liberated from the remnants of the militants. Together with the Syrian authorities, we've succeeded in agreeing, finding an agreement with the illegal militant groups who control the eastern Kalamun area. They will be given opportunity to leave the region. Over the last 2 days, over 5,400 militants and their families were given an opportunity to leave the place and flee to rebel-held city in the northern part of Syria. The infrastructure is being restored. The militants drop dozens of tanks, missiles, lots of light arms, which were previously seized from Syrian army. It is of the biggest interest to us how Western weapons happen to be there, such as anti-tank equipment, TOW, for instance, and others. Russian Reconciliation Center conducts the necessary procedures to let the refugees come back to their homes. Today, the Eastern Ghouta has seen over 62,000 people coming back, returning to their homes. The Idlib de-escalation zone through a corridor near Abu Dhuhr and Deir Sultan settlements saw over 9,500 people return to their normal life. Thanks to the Reconciliation Center and local authorities, we have been restoring the infrastructure in Deir ez-Zor province. Starting from December last year, the eastern bank of the Euphrates River has seen over 44,000 people returning to their homes. Finally, Russian Federation does everything possible to help Syria come to normal life again as soon as possible. Thank you for your attention.
That was Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy, the chief of the Main Operations Directorate of Russia's General Staff at the Russian Ministry of Defense, speaking at a press conference Wednesday. Meanwhile, in Brussels on Wednesday, the High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Federica Mogherini, joined the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, and UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock at a joint press conference after representatives of more than 85 countries and organizations at the ministerial level gathered to discuss humanitarian support for those affected by the war in Syria. This was the High Representative of the EU for Foreign Affairs, Federica Mogherini. She was followed by the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief, Mark Lowcock, and the UN Special Envoy to Syria, Staffan de Mistura. Again, this was in Brussels at a press conference Wednesday.
It was very clear that the European Union and the United Nations together form sort of natural partners in all different fields, but on humanitarian work and on the Syrian crisis in a particular manner. So I'm very grateful and I'm happy about this partnership, and I would like to pay tribute also to the involvement of the Secretary General of the United Nations that opened our conference today via video message. At the international conference we gathered today at the ministerial level, we had representatives of over 85 countries and international organizations, international and Syrian civil society, and we built on last year's conference that we also hosted here in Brussels. 85 very different delegations, bringing together from the Prime Minister of Lebanon to the Deputy Prime Minister of Turkey to the Foreign Minister of Jordan and Iraq, just to mention the neighbors of Syria. Bringing together foreign ministers of countries that normally don't spend much time together, like the foreign minister of Iran, of Saudi Arabia, of Qatar, just to mention a few. Two representatives of Russia, the United States, China, Japan, and I would like to thank the foreign minister for his presence here, South Korea, all the member states of the European Union, but also international organizations that spent with us this day trying to identify common ground. And I would say that this is the first result of today, having this diversity around the table, respect, all delegations listening to each other, and trying to identify some common ground. Obviously, differences didn't disappear over these few hours of talks, and we never expected that. But I believe that we can say we identified common ground on at least two or three issues. One is that there is no military solution to the war in Syria, and that there is a need that everybody recognized to relaunch the political process. In a moment like this, I believe that this common assessment is an important element, especially for the work that Stefan will have to continue. The second element on which I have not found any divergent view is the key role of the United Nations in leading this political process. And this is extremely important for us, the European Union, because we've always consistently identified in the United Nations and in Stefan de Mistura the only legitimate leadership to ensure that the political process is meaningful, is inclusive, represents all Syrians in intra-Syrian talks, and happens along the lines of the UN Security Council resolutions already adopted. And third element on which I have seen a consistent level of convergence is the need to support Syrians inside Syria, in the neighboring countries, with humanitarian aid, financial support, but also to support hosting communities, in particular in the neighboring countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, but also Iraq and Egypt. And obviously, to this regard, I'm sure that Mark will elaborate further. I would expect that the level of financial contribution, the pledges that we gather today, can guarantee the international community to support Syrians in these difficult times. I announced at the beginning of the conference the level of pledges for the European Union is going to be continued and sustained at the same level as last year, not only for this year, but also for next year. I mentioned the numbers already this morning. If you want, I can elaborate more on that. And again, I'm sure that Undersecretary General will be more precise on the expected pledges that you can have today. Obviously, as you know, the conference will go on this afternoon, so more on that level will come during the rest of the day. But let me say one last point, not to repeat myself on messages I've already sent this morning, opening the conference. There was, I would believe, another last political element that all the delegations recognized and shared, and that is the role of the Syrian civil society. We listened to not only one, not only two, not three interventions, elaborated long interventions from representatives of civil society. By the way, let me underline two women and a man, bringing to us a very in-depth analysis of the situation, of the needs and of the hopes of Syrians. And we want, I think, collectively to pay tribute to the work that Syrians are doing, both inside the country and outside of the country, to help their fellow citizens, but also to try and build the basis for reconciliation and the rebuilding of the social fabric of the country once the war will be over. I'll stop here, and I think I will pass immediately the floor to Undersecretary General of the United Nations.
Well, Federica, firstly, thank you very much indeed. I want to start by saying that the United Nations greatly appreciates the collaboration and partnership we have with the EU in organising this second Brussels conference. I want to thank you and your team personally for excellent arrangements over the last couple of days and for your generous hosting of us and your hospitality of us. Thank you very much indeed. My best guess, forecast, assessment, estimate is that by the end of the day, we will have heard pledges for 2018 of $4.4 billion. I want particularly to thank the EU, Germany and the United Kingdom, who've made exceptionally large pledges today. I want also to note that beyond 2018, we've had or are expecting during the course of the day pledges amounting to some $3.3 billion for 2019 and onwards. I want also to note that a number of important donors have not yet been in a position to confirm their financing for 2018 because of the status of their internal budgetary discussions, and that includes the United States, which has been providing something more than $1 billion a year in humanitarian assistance to Syria and the region over recent years. And it also includes the finalisation of the next phase of EU support for Turkey to help meet the costs of the Syrian refugees in Turkey. So I would say that what we've had today is a good start. Obviously, in an ideal world, as is always the case, we would have liked to have raised even more money and to have our appeal fully funded. But we've made a good start. We do have to be realistic that within the resources available to us, there will have to be some prioritisation and choices made. And we're trying to get a fuller picture from all of the financiers of the choices they've made below their headline pledges, including the balance they want between the countries hosting Syrian refugees on the one hand and on the other hand for work to relieve the suffering of those 13 million people inside Syria who still need humanitarian assistance. Within Syria, we will have to focus, and the right thing to do is to focus on the most vulnerable, those in the most acute need. We have to address needs based on the humanitarian principles of independence and impartiality and neutrality. And that's a point that I was keen to emphasise in my remarks at the beginning of the day's proceedings. We can't expect donors to provide the enormous resources we seek if we can't assure them that our help will reach those in greatest need. And that also means having enough UN and agency staff on the ground to assess needs and monitor implementation. It's also important that we continue to deliver results to the people of Syria through the finance we raise. On average, every month during the course of 2017, the UN and its partner organisations was able to reach 7.5 million people a month inside Syria with life-saving food and medical services and water and sanitation, education and other support. And one of my top messages to those financing us is that the money you provide us makes a difference to the lives of Syrians caught up in this horrible crisis. There's absolutely no question that without conferences of this sort and without the financing we secure, things would be a lot worse. Thank you.
Mr. De Mistura.
First of all, thank you, Federica. And on behalf of the Secretary General, you heard it this morning. It's been quite remarkable, this type of alliance or common working together between the EU, yourself, your commitment, and the work of the UN. Now, I won't add to what you said. You're right. We were not expecting today a breakthrough on the political side. We were not expecting that suddenly delegation would start looking at differently from the political side. But we did not have a confrontation. And they were all there in the room. So that's a good sign. Remember, 1 week ago, we were on the brink of a very serious crisis. It was the closest moment to what one could say a very tense Cold War rhetoric and even military activities taking place. Thank God it was avoided, thanks to mature thinking and mature decisions. And the priority of the Secretary General, myself, who went around the whole region, and in the meeting which took place in Stockholm, was lower the temperature, top priority. Syria cannot become the reason for getting that far, not only in a national or regional, but even global environment. So, from that point of view, I think that was achieved, but that doesn't mean that the Security Council has suddenly decided to take away or make away or brush away their own differences. The problem we are facing is that the UN Secretariat can do that much and will continue pushing together with friends like you. But if the Security Council continues being divided and angrily divided, well, we have to realize that that is not good. Now, I took advantage of this opportunity because it was the first one before, after this week of very serious tensions, to go through and analyze what are the current avenues, mechanism for political process. One is called Astana. And I indicated that the Astana duty, the assignment given by themselves, three countries, to themselves, was to de-escalate. They have achieved that last year, and they've been doing quite a lot of progress. But lately, we have been seeing escalation, not de-escalation. And we have seen nothing happening on a very important file for a year, waiting for Astana to deliver, which is the issue about prisoners, of detainees, of missing people. So Astana is in the danger, in my modest opinion, and I'm not the only one, to become seeing its limits, unless they decide to work hard on de-escalation, again, and on detainees. So that's one. Then you have got Sochi. Sochi was a very useful and very important effort. And it did produce a very good proposal. But the problem is that there was no follow-up to it. We have been waiting for the outcome of Sochi to come to Geneva, but there's been no follow-up on it. So Sochi risks also to be considered having produced a stillborn unless there is a proactivity in the famous Constitutional Commission. That leads me to Geneva. Well, all this doesn't help Geneva. That's why I'm waiting and holding the fort about new intra-Syrian talks, because in the current atmosphere, that would not be leading to a discussion, a genuine discussion between the government and the opposition. So where are we? Well, we are at the moment when, in fact, by acknowledging all this, there is a need of high diplomatic contacts between not only the three countries of Astana, who will be meeting again, but many other countries who are stakeholders in what can be the future political solution. If they, thanks to the wake-up call that we all got, but they got too, about the danger we all ran last week, would then start talking to each other on a roadmap, and we have it, it's called 2254. And in that context, very simple, everyone is fighting Daesh, one point. Everyone believes there is no military solution. Let's prove it. How do you do that? Constitutional Commission. And let's work on it. And let's have the government willing to engage on it and the Syrian opposition to be realistically engaging on it. And then elections under UN supervision. The Iraqi foreign minister reminded us, and I was in charge of those elections, so I remember very well, when they started the first elections with UN supervision, it looked impossible. Well, Iraq is not Switzerland yet, but look what the difference. And he was reminding us about it. And last but not least, you need a safe and neutral environment. people should be involved and engaging in elections and the constitution and not risking to be kidnapped, arrested or killed. All that is possible, and today even more urgent than before, since this wake-up call is producing, and I cannot elaborate further, a lot of diplomatic high-level discussions. We are ready in Geneva, and with your help, we can go further.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.